Hello and welcome to the Insights in Focus podcast. I'm Philippa Lamb. This time we're examining best practice when it comes to managing talent under hybrid working. It's over 3 years since the pandemic saw millions of us set up makeshift workspaces in kitchens, sitting rooms and spare bedrooms. Now that shift to hybrid working is being called the most significant change in working practices since the Industrial Revolution. Now, of course, hybrid wasn't new to everyone, but the scale and pace of the recent change has left organisations grappling with tricky questions around recruiting, training, motivating and safeguarding a dispersed workforce. Managers have had to play catch-up, particularly those in sectors such as accounting and financial services, where building strong personal relationships has always been paramount. So now I'm joined by three experts to discuss what we've learned so far and to look at ways forward. Nick Bishop is a partner at North London Accountants BKL. Joe Ludlam is Senior Manager in Change Management at Deloitte. And Kevin Hall is the CEO of training and consulting company Global Integration. Hello, everyone. Thanks for being with us.
Hello.
Hello.
Great
Thanks
to be here.
Now, obviously, hybrid working, it's a big and fast evolving subject. So today we are going to limit ourselves specifically to hybrid rather than the many other forms of flexible working. Kevin, I know you've written a book about this, so why don't you give us a working definition so that we know what we're talking about?
So I think it's been used in two ways. The first way is by individuals who are working themselves in a hybrid pattern. So they're part of the time at home and part of the time in the office, and maybe a third place like a coffee shop. At an organisational level, it can also include people who are fully remote, people who are fully in the office, and people who are a mixture of the two. So it's a combination of those two definitions.
Shall we move on to what we know so far and hear a bit about all your own experiences of managing this shift to hybrid? I mean, Nick, I know it did exist pre-pandemic to a certain extent, didn't it? But what does it look like now at BKL?
Mostly it was with the people who had clearly defined roles and had been their roles a long time. With an accountancy firm, so much of it is to do with training. So that was the biggest issue that we found with it. So nowadays we have our trainees starting tend to be almost fully in the office. And after they've got the experience necessary, that's when they move on to sort of the hybrid model and where they're 2 or 3 days in the office. Because we all accept that there are things we can do better when we're at home in our own personal space without the distractions around us of the office. So it's trying to meld and get the best of both worlds for people at different levels throughout the firm.
Remind me how many people you've got under the roof?
So we've got roughly about 200 people in one office in North London.
And is everyone doing hybrid working to one degree or another?
Pretty much everyone. It is the new starters who we want to have in the office to give them the training, the best training possible, and get them into the BKL way before it starts. But then if you've been here and you know your job and you know what you're doing, most people do a blend of hybrid working at all levels.
Joe, Deloitte, you're a huge employer. Is there a defined form of hybrid across the organisation, or have different departments found their own way?
Yeah, so 23,000 nationally for Deloitte. And hybrid for us is all about choice and flexibility. So we haven't mandated a set number of days that our people need to work anywhere. We trust them to choose when and how they do their best work. And if that's in the office, great. If that's at home, if that's a blend of both, if that's with their clients, they've got that choice and freedom to do that.
So who decides in individual departments how that's going to work?
Individuals decide, but what we have made clear is we all have professional responsibilities, and so that needs to be balanced within the choices that we make. So those professional commitments that we have, that should be included in the choices and considered in those choices that we make around our flexibility.
So Kevin, I mean, you offer training consultancy in this area alongside various other consulting roles. I know your clients range in size from multinationals down to smaller organisations. I mean, is it fair to say that offering hybrid, it's just obligatory now? You have to.
It's really hard not to, isn't it? And I imagine a lot of your members are quite mobile. They've got transferable skills. And if you're in that kind of world, IT is seeing it most, I think, at the moment. You'd better offer a hybrid option if you want to attract real talent. And we have clients who have online application processes. And what they're finding is if people are working through the process and they get to a page that says, this is full-time in the office, about 75% of people are dropping out of the process.
I mean, that's a really startling number, isn't it? So was that the case pretty well straight off, or is that number just rising and rising and rising in the last year or two?
The last data I saw on it didn't suggest it was rising. It had kind of reached a plateau level, I think. It's interesting. In some parts of the world, because we operate globally, there is a little bit of a drift back to the office. So in China, for example, people seem to be going back into the office more in Hong Kong. And I think some of that's about what's my alternative working space. If you're living in a small apartment in Hong Kong and the public transport is great, maybe you quite like to go in the office. We've got clients who, you know, younger clients in Sydney who really want to go in the office, particularly on a Friday, because they go out with their friends in the evening. So there's that kind of pattern. I think people are finding their natural level. And that's why I think things like choice are really important.
Yeah, because, I mean, as you say, we tend to assume, those of us who like hybrid working, that everyone wants to do it. But some people actually do, and they are on the record as saying they would rather be in the office 5 days a week. So there's a problem there for them now, isn't it? Because if they can go in, but the chances are there's not many other people there.
I think that's a challenge. You know, I often hear from people who say, well, particularly ones who mandate, you must be in the office 3 days a week, who say, well, I commute for an hour, I go into the office and I spend all day doing my emails or joining virtual meetings because the people I want to speak with aren't in the office. And that's clearly a complete waste of time.
Talking of meetings is one of the kind of range of challenges, isn't it? But there's a lot of specifics around making hybrid meetings work, aren't there?
There are. If you think about the way we exercise our skills, virtually every soft skill in the future will be exercised in a world where some people are there and some people are joining virtually. And that's a real challenge. And it's been going on for years. International teams have worked that way forever. Sales teams have worked that way forever. But being able to engage and involve people, it's so compelling in the room. You catch someone's eye, you have the conversation going. But to interrupt that, to be part of that remotely, is a real challenge. And I don't think the technology's caught up with that yet. And I certainly don't think people's facilitation skills to create that engagement have caught up.
Yeah, Joe, tell us, you must encounter this all the time.
We've done a lot of work in this space, actually, to equip those people that are hosting hybrid meetings. You know, we're all very used to doing it in person and very quickly got used to doing it remotely and effectively. But actually, the challenge comes when you've got that blend of in-person and remote people dialing into the same conversation. So what we've done is equip our people to host those effective sessions, you know, making it really clear in terms of what their objectives are, their outcomes are, being more deliberate in how they plan for those workshops so that they can really get the outcomes that they're desiring. And it's all about inclusivity here, right? So you've got that blend of in-person and remote, as I've said. So how are we going to include all of those people in that one conversation? And that is about the effective facilitation, I believe.
Okay, so how do they actually do that then? Is it about just being very watchful about who's contributing and who isn't?
Very considered in the approach, very planned and deliberate ahead of the session, you know, sharing the agenda well in advance so people can prepare for the conversation that they want to have and get out of it what they want out of it. Using the tools effectively, actually understanding the platforms that you're using. I mean, Teams is great. You've got the raise your hand function in there. You know, that's used a lot. But if you don't set those house rules at the start, you're kind of on the back foot there. So, you know, making that really clear in terms of how you want the session to be run, those house rules, those top tips, you know, setting them out at the start can really help those people, especially joining remotely.
Nick, I've wondered about this because it does seem to me that actually meetings are in some ways better now than they used to be because everyone got a bit lax about meeting discipline, didn't they, before the pandemic? Showing up late, unprepared, there was no agenda, no one's really chairing. That's kind of going away, isn't it? Because it just doesn't work with hybrid.
Yeah, as Joe says, you have to be really focused on what you want to get out of the meeting. But I think it needs a really strong leader as well who's leading the meeting to bring everyone in. I think we've all been on the receiving end of it when we're watching a group in a room and actually the technology that isn't quite up to scratch yet, so it's all a bit garbled. Yes. So you have to be very clear who's speaking, and also whoever's leading the meeting has to bring the people in the screen in, and they have to be almost ultra observant to be able to watch to see if there are people who want to have a point, but maybe because there's that minuscule lag you get, and whether they want to actually make a point before the conversation moves on. So I find the meetings actually go at a slightly slower pace, but the quality of them is much better.
So do you directly train your people then to do this?
Yes, yeah, we try best of our ability. It's still a work in progress. We're still all learning. The technology is constantly improving as well. So all our boardrooms now fitted to be able to host these meetings. But there's still that, say, minuscule lag and a bit of garbled chat when you're all off one microphone.
Kevin.
One of the things that I think people have evolved from virtual meetings, I think virtual meetings have got a little bit more structured, but unfortunately...
Where everyone is remote.
Yeah. And I think even in a hybrid world, some people are choosing to still meet fully virtually the people in the office and the people remotely, because it levels the playing field.
Yes.
It's a phrase people use a lot. But there's some inclusive techniques that you could build there. For example, instead of just asking an open question about, you know, how's our decision making, we would ask, on a scale of 1 to 10, how's our decision making? Put it in chat, hold up a piece of paper with it on, and then you call out the very different opinions. And it's a way of capturing and magnifying outlying voices and being more inclusive. So there's little techniques like that you can build in. But it's early days, I think, for a lot of people.
Yes, and there is a lot more process, isn't there? A lot more process. I mean, I wonder, are we losing spontaneous interjections and creativity? Does it matter? Do you feel the loss of that in these meetings?
I think the spontaneity is more considered. And as accountants, maybe spontaneity is not really high up the list of things we want from our meetings. We want a bit more of a considered approach. So
I suppose I was thinking about ideas generation rather than anything else.
But I think anything which you're going to miss in a second or two in a meeting possibly is going to be picked up on the longer the thought process, and the people working or dialing remotely can have that a bit more time to process it rather than the people in the room who feel like they have to contribute. So actually, I'm not sure that's such a big issue.
It's feeling like you're all generally quite pro, thinking that the meetings are working better than before. Would that be fair to say?
I'd say we've got better at it. You know, okay. We've improved over the last 12 to 18 months, and but because we've had to, you know, it's the way of working now. And if we want to be collaborative and we want to be successful in this, then we've got to kind of really work at it and learn from others and improve as we go along. We've done a lot of listening to our people in terms of, you know, how is this working? What improvements do we need to make? And the feedback has been really positive. I mean, 96% of our people want the freedom to choose how flexibly they work, you know, in the future. And we've seen that really come to life through our hybrid approach.
I mean, what about learning and development more widely? We've touched on it in various answers so far, but how do you manage learning in this new environment? Because obviously learning by osmosis, it doesn't work, does it? So what's different now to how it was before?
I think it's got to be much more of a structured learning plan. So you almost have to push the learning out. It's the same with everything. I think a lot of the stuff we've already discussed and will discuss going forward is about planning more for two ways of working. And I think it works for the technical approach. You can push out the technical material and people like to be able to consume it in their own time, whatever time of the day it works best for them. I think where it really falls down at the moment is learning what you don't know. So if you're looking for progression, moving up the ladder, and you're sitting there by yourself in your room doing your work, particularly, I presume, very competently, but you don't know what the next person up the rung is doing. You don't know what your manager does on a day-to-day basis, and not sitting next to them means you don't get that exposure. So I think that's one of the really big issues with hybrid working, is if you are looking to progress your career quickly, sitting in a room by yourself doesn't give you the best platform to do that.
Yeah, Joe?
I think it's about being really purpose-led with the reasons why you do get together with your colleagues or your peers in person and having a real clear agenda around that. And so we've been encouraged to think about the moments that matter to us, you know, the moments that matter in our career. And learning is absolutely one of those fundamental moments that matter. And so if being in person is recognised as a space where you do learn from others and observe others, then you should be prioritising that. And we're all encouraged to include that in our thinking and choices that we're making.
It's more planning, isn't it? Because those spontaneous coaching conversations that we all talked about so much in the last kind of 10 years of how beneficial they can be between colleagues and line managers and other people, and just stuff that pops up, you just take 5 minutes to, you know, learn something new about it. They are largely gone, aren't they, in this environment? So, Kevin, I mean, how does that work? What replaces that?
It's tough because also this learning of tacit knowledge, and you were talking about bringing people into the office early stage of their career, which makes a lot of sense because we often say that culture is kind of caught, not taught. But if we don't have the same bandwidth to do that, we've got to start teaching it, yeah. You know, and so we've got to be more intentional, as both of you have already said. But it isn't easy, and the delivery of skills has got to be different, so we need to kind of adapt our skills for a world where some people are present and others not. There's an issue with tacit knowledge because the people who want the knowledge are keen to come into the office and learn it, but the people who've got the knowledge maybe aren't so keen to come in because they're not seeing the benefits. So yes. We may be asking people to come into the office when it doesn't really suit them in order to transfer tacit knowledge. So I think a lot of it's about codifying this stuff and make it more intentional. But there are some benefits. So we're about to onboard a new trainer. And in the old world, they would have gone and been face-to-face with people. So they'd probably have seen our training course a week. you know, or maybe two if we're really busy. Now they can probably see six short webinar training courses in a week, and they can see six different trainers delivering it. So our ability to transfer that kind of tacit knowledge has actually increased because we can access a broader talent base.
Do they learn as deeply when they're learning at that sort of pace?
To learn a two-day in-the-room face-to-face course is a tremendous amount of material. To learn a 90-minute webinar where you've got the slides with you, you've got the trainer's notes, is much quicker. So actually what we've found is we're creating more building blocks and building up rather than the first time you have to do this is 2 days with 20 people staring at you. It's actually easier to build from the bottom up than to start with that.
So in terms of cost on learning and development, higher now?
It seems to be that webinar delivery is becoming the norm for a lot of stuff with distributed teams, distributed organisations. And that's lower cost by a huge margin because you're not getting people together. You're not paying for facilities. There's no travel time. People can do a morning and be back at work 30 minutes after the thing's finished. So there's been a huge reduction in cost, I think, in that sense.
But you're having to do more training in areas that you didn't have to train for specifically before. Would that be fair to say? I mean, we've all talked about training you're offering, Joe, Nick, that you weren't offering before.
It's the softer skills that you have to train, which is almost hard to train as accountants. We like facts, and I'm generalising massively, but as accountants we like facts and figures and like things we can get our
tacit
teeth
knowledge
into.
Yeah,
whereas actually now learning the skills to deal with hybrid work and hybrid management and how you best work at home, it's all fairly new, and Kevin has much more experience at giving that than we do, but it's something we're now having to teach our managers explicitly, whereas when everyone's in the office you just sort of picked it up from the manager above you.
And how's that going down? I'll come to you, Kevin, but I'm interested to know what the response to that is, because presumably it's mixed, is it?
It is, and people don't see the value in it because they don't see necessarily where it adds value to the firm, because it's hard to put a number on it. So again, as accountants we like to
I want
put
to talk
a number
about metrics later. Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, it's hard to deal with, and it's sort of a bit longer term as well, because it's deal with staff turnover and attracting talent and all that sort of thing, which is hard to pin down.
Yeah, contributes to the business, but it's hard to quantify. Kevin, you had a thought.
Yeah, I like what Nick was saying there, because many times over the last couple of years, you know, since the pandemic onwards, managers have said to me, you know, I'd never sat down and talked with my team about our way of working before. We'd never spoken about how should we collaborate, why do we meet. We just kind of picked it up by osmosis.
Yeah.
And I think it's hugely positive to do that and to be intentional about why are we getting together? Why are we meeting? Why are we having this conversation? I think that's been a really positive thing.
Joe?
We developed a tool specifically designed to do that. So a tool simply called the Ways of Working Framework. Everyone in our firm is encouraged to use it. And essentially it builds on you as an individual, what's important to you about your ways of working. And then you collectively come together as a team and have a conversation about, right, considering all of the individual needs, how are we going to make this project work? How are we going to deliver this this engagement successfully? How often do we meet in person? And what is the purpose around that? If we are dialing in virtually, what are the platforms that we're using? And actually just being really upfront and open conversation around how you're going to deliver that. The teams that have use this framework are the ones that are really, really thriving in this way of working. And so it's great to see that a tool like that can, you know, really benefit people.
So that's a negotiated outcome, because obviously there's going to be conflicting demands, presumably from team
it's
members.
It's a mutual agreement.
Well, that kind of brings us rather nicely to culture, doesn't it? About how all these things are done now. Hybrid teams, as I understand it, and Joe's just kind of explained this to us, seem to be pretty good, given sufficient support, at bonding together and working well. Is it a problem bonding those teams with each other now across a big organisation? Is that an issue, Kevin?
There's some really nice Microsoft data on this where they studied 3.2 billion data points, I think, of meetings and emails and calls and connections. And what they found is that during the pandemic, particularly, teams did a really good job of bonding themselves, as you said. And so I'm less worried about the ability of teams to function because they come together around a common goal.
But do they get
siloed?
But
then we've got all of the, that's what the data showed. That bonding was at the expense of what they call bridging to other parts of the organisation. So it's the stuff that happens between teams, like culture, like communication, like the potential for silos, that I think is the area we need to work on.
So how do you avoid that then? I mean, how do you build trust and a common culture across a large organisation, or even a relatively small one? SMEs must have this problem too. There is this suggestion of using boundary spanners, Joe. Do you use them at Deloitte? This people who are directly tasked with linking groups and teams together so they collaborate properly?
I've not actually heard of that term before myself, but what I think we do really well at Deloitte is through our inclusive culture. So breaking down those silos, we've got 12 diversity networks, for example, across the firm nationally as well. And a great example recently for Ramadan, our Muslim network hosted a Fast and Curious Challenge where they invited colleagues from all over the firm to participate in a day of fasting. And a really great show of allyship, companionship, communities, regardless of geographical boundaries, you know, and it really showed that kind of support for a network like that. And it was just a really great turnout across the firm and really great to see.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, culturally, that sort of thing is lovely, isn't it? In terms of working together on hard tasks, do you need more process in place to make sure that the teams even really know each other now?
So I found it actually, the team from working on a task worked better when we're all hybrid, because the methods of communication that have come in due to the hybrid working mean it's much easier to get hold of the people you need. So that's a sort of a basic level. If you're asking a technical question, you get a very quick and very easy to get a technical answer. Well, I think Kevin was alluding to it, it's the higher level stuff where the team, you go with a particular technical question, but that might not be the right question you're asking that technical person. And without the real knowledge and the proximity for the whole team to be working on the project together, yeah, that's when you miss out on some of the what you don't know is what we're,
yes,
I think that's a big theme of what we know. You know what you know, don't know what you don't know. And that's the bit which you lose out by not working quite so closely together.
And you can't just get in the lift, go down a couple of floors, introduce yourself to a different team, can you?
But the interesting thing is we didn't used to do that face to face. I mean, people say, well, when we're in the office, everybody used to talk. If you're in different floors in the building, you are almost never talk.
I see what you mean.
I think called the Allen curve, which shows how quickly communication falls off. And what he found amongst engineers, this was a big study, once people were 10 metres apart, they hardly ever spoke. So I think it's finding intentional reasons to connect. You know, that's a great example with the Muslim network. There are lots of ways you can do it, but you have to do it. You know, and I've been having conversations with a number of clients recently who were saying, well, you know, how do we make sure our culture is authentic? I said, well, look, culture is always authentic because culture is what you do.
This is a serious issue, isn't it? Because, I mean, a huge amount of work, endeavour and cash has been, you know, dedicated to culture, what it is in organisations, the importance of it, the sustainability element of it. But there is a real danger here, isn't there, that culture becomes inauthentic, or at least it becomes very patchily embedded. It becomes not a thing that's organisation-wide. It becomes the team's culture, and then there's the other team's culture. So, I mean, do you see this as a problem going forward that perhaps we haven't thought about enough yet?
It's a problem, but it's also an opportunity, because you have the opportunity to think about what you want your culture to be. And then if you're hybrid working, people in the office 2 or 3 days a week, that's when they get their impression of the culture of the firm. So you almost have to be really on it with what you're pushing your culture to be, so that when they do work from home, they know exactly what the firm culture is. So it almost has to be forcefully pushed out there in a way that it didn't have to be. And you have to be on your game almost all the time.
So does that mean that there really is merit in making people come into the office a certain number of days a week or a month? Because you don't get that otherwise, do you, if you say you can always work from home?
No, but I guess we are talking hybrid working, so I am assuming there is a level of interaction in the office every week.
It can be very small, though, can't it, some organisations?
Yeah. So 1 or 2 days a week.
Or less.
Yeah, we have people who live up in Newcastle who come down 2 or 3 days a month. And it's making sure that they foster the connections when they're here and the culture is firm when they're here, that they know exactly what they're going to get. And the thought of BKL is still there when they're sitting on their own up in Newcastle.
So that's about process and planning again, isn't it? Making sure the experience when people come in matches the sort of thing that you've been talking about.
And storytelling as well, I think. So from our leadership, them being open, having conversations with their teams about how they're working, the choices they're making around their flexibility, why they're in today, because it's this purpose, I'm getting this value out of it. Why tomorrow I might be working at home because I'm stacked with back-to-back calls and actually it just works for me to be plugged into my laptop for the day at home. Having those open conversations, sharing those examples can just, again, break down those barriers and actually open the conversation up so that people are welcomed into that, you know, into their choices that they're making.
So I think everything we've talked about so far, it's been about intention, hasn't it? Planning and intention. And I do want to ask you about productivity. There's been so much in the media, some saying that it's improved, some saying it's drastically, you know, diminished. What has been your experience on productivity, Nick?
We found that generally productivity has increased because you almost have two different sides to your job now. You have the side which is done at home with minimal distractions and you can just get your head down and work. And then you have your time in the office, which is very much spent doing your meetings, your teamwork, your training. So actually it gives people focus to their day, and they use that. And if they're having a busy week, they might flex their hours more towards the home bit. Whereas if they're doing sort of finalising a task, working the team, they might do a bit more in the office. So actually, I think by segregating them out into almost two different forms of work, it actually helps the productivity.
Okay, sure.
I mean, I'm not sure if there's a real silver bullet in terms of measuring productivity accurately, yeah. But what I can say is the firm has grown, you know, in this way of working. You know, we've grown by 3,000 people in the last 2 years. We continue to grow to that rate. We remain one of the largest graduate recruiters in the country as well. So we're recognised in that kind of talent pool. We did a study recently, actually, and there's an interesting stat. 3/4 of UK Gen Zs and millennials said that they would consider leaving an employer if they were mandated to come in full time. So I think from a talent perspective, flexibility and choice is hugely important.
I mean, that's interesting, isn't it? Because that is the age group, Gen Z, that we were told, you know, did not necessarily want to be at home because they didn't have space, nice spaces to work in. And there's, you know, 4 or 5 of them around a tiny kitchen table. But that's not the data you're getting.
No, I mean, they value that choice. You know, they want to go in when their colleagues are in, when they're going to learn, when they've got the opportunities to socialise, build that network. But again, choosing to stay at home when it suits them and their social aspects as well and family time. So, yeah, that choice just works.
Okay, Kevin, your thoughts on productivity?
Yeah, it's a complex one, is productivity, because if you ask people, are you more productive, they always say yes. But you
of
also
course,
ask them, would
yes.
you like to stay working remotely? They say yes, please. So I think we have to be a little bit cautious about that data.
Yeah.
There was some data before the pandemic about remote working, and generally speaking, that showed a higher productivity for people who worked remotely. But it was limited data.
I was going to say,
like
across all
centers,
job roles and seniorities?
A lot of it was in things like call centres even. You know,
okay.
So quite surprising to me, that would lead to higher productivity. Very often, I think productivity is one of these excuses by managers who would really like to have people back in the office. You know, they'll say to me, well, what's the impact on productivity? And I always say, well, how did you used to measure it? And they say, we didn't. And I said, then why is it suddenly so important to you? So there's kind of a trust thing behind the productivity. We have a few clients who measure, and you know, it sounds like you may have, in your kind of role, Nick, you may have more opportunity to measure performance. One of our clients is a global law firm, and of course they measure everything to the 10-minute slot. They've seen a measurable increase. So the data I've seen has shown an increase, but it's one of those concerns, and I think behind the concern is trust.
We have heard from line managers who want people back in. I'm interested, why do you think they want people back in? Because of a concern that they don't feel they can measure performance well enough? Is it something about shortcomings in the metrics, if that's the anxiety they have?
I would say, I mean, 30 years we've been training people to work remotely. In all of that time, consistently, the main objection is managers' need for control.
Okay.
I think it's a simple
And that's
as that.
Line, literally line of sight.
Yeah.
With people.
You look at the word, you know, supervisor. It's all about being able to see somebody, overseer, you know, these old words for management. And I think it reveals a gap in the skill set of some managers. And it also is a trust issue.
Have you come across that, Nick?
I think so. And a lot of the stuff we've spoken about today has been about managing people remotely and how we do that and upskilling the managers to put the culture on and to help manage the teams and run the meetings effectively.
Yeah, the work has landed in their laps, hasn't it?
Yeah, but that's what they're paid for. The clue's in the title.
Sure.
They are managers.
Sure.
So it's just managing a different pool of people.
Have you encountered reluctance from some people? I'm not asking you to name names, but just a general sense as I'd rather have them back in?
No, not necessarily. I think everyone appreciates the work that can be done. Where we have asked for people to come in a bit more often is where maybe they're falling behind compared to their peers. So they need a bit more face-to-face time with their manager to sort of, say, ram home the learning. Embed the learning. Embed, it gives some more hands-on help, which is harder to do remotely. So I think remote work or hybrid working works really well. If you know your role, you're confident in your role. If you're looking to move up or you're falling slightly behind, we haven't quite worked out a substitute for face-to-face learning yet.
Yeah. I mean, Joe, there must have been some problems with hybrid.
I don't think I can comment on the problems, but I think this comes back to the professional responsibilities again, is, you know, everyone has their commitments to their work. And if that means that you should be in person with your team, you know, creating that culture, creating that workload, you know, managing that workload effectively, then that should be part of the choices that you're making. You know, it comes back to that professional responsibility in the role that you do, whether it's a manager, whether you're starting out in your career, you know, what are your responsibilities and how can you navigate hybrid to enable those responsibilities effectively?
Kevin, if I was to ask you about key wins and key losses of hybrid working, what would you say?
I do think the ability to attract talent from a geographically dispersed group, you know, it cannot be that the best software programmers in the world all want to live in San Francisco, for example. And so the ability to access that talent pool, I think, is a massive win for organizations. And as part of that, the ability to access different ideas, diverse points of view and all those kind of things. So I think that's a win-win. There's clearly a societal win in terms of less commuting and travel and yes. people having more time Green with their win. Families and all those kind of things, which is fantastic. That was always a big factor for me in working remotely, that I could balance a busy work life with family. And I think productivity as well for me. We always managed to recruit people who were massively overskilled for a small organisation or massively over-talented, if you like, because we were just that bit more flexible. And so we hired some great people, even though we were a very small organisation, because we were more flexible than the rest of the world.
Downside?
Downside, because I've worked remotely for so long now, I don't see a lot of downsides. I do know that all of the current concerns around culture, around innovation, they can be fixed. And many organisations have been doing it for decades. So I don't really see any downside unless you own a building or you're operating a coffee shop in the middle of London where you're losing traffic as the economy moves away from that. But I think that's part of the normal development of work.
Indeed. I mean, Joe, I think you're attached to the real estate team, aren't you, at Deloitte? Give us your key wins and losses.
Key win for me would be from a wellbeing perspective. I think flexibility just allows you to balance, you know, what you've got going on elsewhere, and just being able to manage your wellbeing in a more effective way, I think, is really important. I think the presenteeism has dropped. You know, there's a reduction in that presenteeism, that need to be physically in person in front of someone. That's yeah. So, you know, from a wellbeing perspective, I think that's amazing. Downside for me, I think, is time. I think it does take more time to be more deliberate, more planned, to do things effectively. And I think, you know, we're all up against time constraints in our vast roles. So, yeah, time for me would be a downside. But I think we're learning more efficient ways to do things.
I'm interested just to think about some of the savings that organisations can have, because I think we've heard about, was it Google is thinking about reducing the catering, on-site catering, because there just aren't people in. Concierge services, laundry, all those sort of things. Presumably these are costs that are going away in organisations a bit, aren't they?
Certainly reducing,
yeah,
for obvious reasons. And if you're in facilities management, that's an issue for you in finding that. But it's kind of, people say, well, are we spending less? Well, yeah. We're just spending different. You know, yeah. So like as individuals, we're not spending so much going into London and eating in a coffee shop, but we're still spending the money. We're spending it in local communities or on leisure or other things. So it's a switch in the economy. If I might, I just want to pick up something that Joe mentioned there, which is this risk of proximity bias. I think it was kind of behind what something that you were saying. When we speak to leaders, that's their biggest concern, that some people will be treated differently because they happen to be physically present relative to the ones that aren't. And I think creating that similar employee experience across the remote staff and across in the office staff is going to be one of the biggest leadership challenges.
The real challenge, yeah. Nick, wins and losses.
As Kevin said, I think the biggest win is the work-life balance. People get to choose how much time they spend in the office and not, and they want to spend it with their family or doing other activities. In terms of losers, I think it's the relationship side of it. You're really missing out on fostering the really deep relationships, and we are still a relationship business, and that's what's going to intrigue me going forward. Are we just moving away? Is the whole industry and our relationship with clients, for example, yeah. going to change?
It's not just in-house, is it?
Yeah. And it's not, audits don't need to be done on site anymore, so we can do audits remotely. So is that going to change the relationships we have, and does that change the expectations of our audit clients as well? So I think that's, I'm not sure if it's a loser at the moment, but I'm intrigued to see where that goes in the future.
One to watch.
Very much so.
My sense is there is going to be a lot more to discuss here, isn't there, as hybrid embeds over long periods of time. Is that your feeling too?
I think so. I think we're all still learning as managers and as people working remotely, on a hybrid schedule. So there's lots to still take in and many lessons to be learned.
Joe, Kevin, Nick, thank you all very much for coming in. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great conversation.
The next Insights podcast will be with you in early June, when we'll hear from experts across ICAW about the latest developments affecting the work of chartered accountants. Later in June, the Insights in Focus podcast will return. We'll be discussing the progress made in sustainability assurance and whether it is simply too costly for many SMEs. Join us for those two. Thanks for being with us today. And remember to rate, review, share and subscribe to the series on your podcast app.